Pleasure to be back with you again today. I was here back in October, I believe it was. I probably mentioned when I was here before that I'm a full-time student in seminary now. And it seems like over the last 50 years I've either been teaching in higher education or been a student in higher education. So I been a wonderful opportunity at the seminary for lifelong learning. I read with interest, it was about a year ago. I keep up with issues in higher education, things going on in universities, the whole enterprise of education beyond high school intrigues me at how this works. And that institution, after 4 years of study, or more, a student gets a certificate for all of that effort and all that money that goes into that. As a commodity, it's an odd kind of a situation because it's an abstract kind of a concept to say you've arrived at a certain level to be able to get a diploma from an institution. And ultimately, in my background in teaching, I think really what's being sold is the idea that a person can engage in critical thinking, which is an area of logic and philosophy. But anyway, I read with interest in the Chronicle of Higher Education that Ohio State University was doing away with the ACT as a required test, an aptitude test you take when you're like a senior in high school. And I used to teach at Ohio State, and it was a convenient way to sort through applications that students with certain scores would get in and students with lower scores would not. But anyway, they did away with requiring the ACT, and I remember I was looking at that thinking, well, how are they going to make these judgments? You'd have to really study the transcripts and this sort of thing. And sure enough, a couple of weeks later, based on my experience teaching up there, I knew some people over in admissions, and they contacted me and said, do you want to be part of a team that will review applications and render judgments of acceptance or rejection? And I told them, so I'm in the seminary. And they arranged this, so there's a whole team of us, and we do it part-time, and we do it online, but where we review applications. And as I go through these applications, it just brings it to the forefront for me that how abstract this process is. Where ultimately the question I ask when I'm reviewing applications of high school seniors is, would this student do well in a class of mine? Would they be able to do the work? But anyway, in reading these applications, I see how deeply students really want into this institution. Their dreams, their hopes and dreams and aspirations are tied to this. And I feel bad when I have to suggest that we not accept. And that doesn't mean the end of the story, that there's other institutions they'll be able to go to. But Ohio State at this point in time is a very competitive institution. I mean, it's very hard to get into that, and it didn't used to be that way. But anyway, I bring this up because in my work in the universities, I found that there are universities that will promote degrees, majors that really are not worthwhile, okay, that their students aren't really learning that much. And it'll be trending, but it'll be a major that sounds like fun. It would have been something that would have attracted me 50 years ago when I was a high school senior, but it's not really worth it, okay? This is an abstract kind of a decision, and it's one that a high school senior is not equipped to make. As far as deciding what's worthwhile and what's not. And when I see this going on, and by the way, it's gone on for years, it's a false prophecy. It's a false prophet that sell this. And it's so common in the university world that we call them cash cows, programs that don't really deliver that much for the student, but it brings money into an institution. And when this happens, this is where we get the student debt debacle that we have now, so many people in debt, to get a credential that basically certifies they've learned certain things, but they really haven't, and they get out into the world of work, and they can't keep a job very well, they can't make a salary, they can't make these payments, okay? And this, by the way, is going on now, but it has gone on back to the time of the ancient Greeks. My background's in rhetoric, which is Socrates and Aristotle. They had a name for people that did this, that would put together courses that were really meaningless. They called them sophists. They talked about the sophists being a rhetoric of false preaching. It goes back to biblical times, and that's why I wanted to have these scriptures today, in that we have people making proclamations that are not true for their own gain. And it's usually at the loss of other people. So again, I want to kind of stress this from 2 Peter verses 1 through 14, just some excerpts that were read before, just to highlight this for where I'm going with this with you today. False prophets appeared in the past among the people, and in the same way, false teachers will appear among you. In their greed, these false teachers will make a profit out of telling you made-up stories. These false teachers are bold and arrogant and show no respect for the glorious beings above. They lead weak people into a trap. Their hearts are trained to be greedy. So, as I proceed with this, it's based on this premise that we have to kind of, as we live our lives, be aware that there are people that will tell us things that are not false. People that are in positions of authority, where we kind of have to make a decision, is this on the up and up? If you've raised a child, you know that and I found this raising my son, that you want to groom them to be respectful of adults, but at the same time, be careful about adults you don't know, and sometimes even be careful about adults you do know. Okay, and it's a lot of gray areas there. There are a lot of false prophets that exist. And it's on a variety of fronts. Sometimes it's bold-faced, kind of like the illustration I'm just giving. Other times, it's really gray areas even for an adult. A couple months ago, anybody who's grown up in Columbus and close to my age, I'm sure you saw the story in the news that Eastland Mall closed. And I don't know if I'm cursed or blessed, but I have a good memory. I have just a strong memory. Sometimes I can meet somebody 5 minutes later and forget their name, but other times I just remember things from my youth, different times in life. And I remember the first time I entered the hollow halls of Eastland Shopping Center. And I was in high school. And I just got my driver's license, you know, at 16, and I'm like out discovering the world, you know. And I remember driving out Hamilton Road, coming up over 70, and it was at Christmas time, and Interstate 70, and I saw just all these cars going into this building, and it was so orderly, you could get in and park and go inside. And it was winter, I could do my coat out in the car, because it was always a comfortable 72 degrees. You know, and all that, but it was just like a mecca of capitalism and consumerism. And when I say capitalism, consumerism, I'm not bashing that. I'm all for it. You know, this is a capitalistic society we live in, and we have to kind of tenor that a little bit as far as, you know, keep it in check. But anyway, I remember looking around thinking, wow, we have arrived. So to think that this is closed, I thought, you know, it was bigger than life. You know, there were spinoff stores that were out on Hamilton Road. They weren't even in the mall, but just by virtue of being close, that they were blessed too, and they were, you know, part of this phenomenon. But anyway, when I saw that closed, I just scratched my chin like, wow, how that's really strange that I hadn't noticed the demise of it. But anyway, it got me to thinking in my life that before Eastland Mall, I remember as a small child that Town and Country over in Whitehall was the place to go. The Boston store, and I remember my mom would go over there, Penny's, Preston's, Hobby Land. And then you would kind of hopscotch downtown. Once a year, we would go down to downtown Lazarus for Christmas, sit on Santa's knee and that sort of thing. But anyway, you'll remember, if you remember Town and Country, you'll remember, remember Whitehall Discount City. That was another
yes.
But Shopper's Fair. A little later in life, I was in elementary school, and I remember when Northland Mall opened. And the concept of a mall, I just knew to me, it wasn't an indoor mall, but it was outdoor. Anyway, that was kind of like an eye-opener. And there was a movie theater there. The first time I ever went to there, up there on to Northland, we saw Mary Poppins. And I thought, look at this. This is not only shopping. This is a movie thing. They got food and, a whole new level. And then Eastland came, and it was enclosed. And then, the whole parade of them, City Center, Tuttle Mall, and then Polaris Fashion Place. Okay, isn't that what they call a fashion place? Okay, the higher end. And then, of course, we are now at, we all bow and kowtow to Easton. Okay, and these are, given my background, studying social orders as kind of a sociologist, these things just intrigue me to no end. I'm not opposed to them at all, but they are celebrations of capitalism and celebrations of consumerism and materialism. Okay, now I'm not against those things. It's just part of our culture and how we live. But when you live this way, you there are all kinds of claims that are coming at you. And these claims are of, if you buy this product, you'll feel better about yourself. You'll be a better person. You'll be smarter and just all that kind of thing. When you're exposed to that, you kind of learn how to differentiate, like, what's legitimate and what's not. Okay. I was talking a little bit with Amy right before, when I came in for the service start, and she was talking about being over in China. I have a background working with the Chinese. And something I tell them when they arrive here, I used to help recruit students over at the University of Cincinnati. And when they would get here, I would tell them, and these were people I had taught over in Beijing, but I'd sit down with them and say, hey, now look, you're going to see a lot of advertisements, and don't spend your money foolishly. There are people that will make false claims and tell you that their product can do something that it can't. And the reason why is in China, back in the 80s, when I first started going over there, they didn't have advertisements. It's a socialist society. The government basically made all these decisions for you. And I found that the Chinese, when they got here, they weren't prepared to kind of weed through all of this of what's true and what's not. So again, these are things that we learn over time. Now, I want to kind of go back to the scriptures of Mark, chapter 13, verse 5, and you'll kind of see where we get this idea of false prophets. Jesus said to them, "Watch out, and don't let anyone fool you. Many men claiming to speak for me will come and say, 'I am he,' and they will fool many people." Similarly, in Luke chapter 20, verses 46 and 47, "Be on your guard against the teachers of the law who like to walk around in their long robes and love to be greeted with respect in the marketplace, who choose the reserved seats in the synagogues and the best places at feasts, who take advantage of widows and rob them of their homes, and then make a show of saying long prayers." Sometimes false prophets make these bold claims. I mean, where they just come right out and try to make a sale. Okay. Other times, it gets more and more abstract. It's almost just kind of in the fabric of how we live that some of these claims sort of exist amongst us. We just started tomorrow is the third week of second semester up at the seminary. And we had our first semester. But January is typically a month people take off just to kind of regroup and get ready for the next semester. But for people who can't get enough, they offer January term courses. And these are courses that are condensed into 4 weeks instead of over the course of the semester. And I enrolled in, one of the ones I enrolled into was working with the homeless. And for 1 week, it was like the last week of January, I lived and worked among the homeless down on Parsons Avenue and at the United Methodist Church over on Broad Street. And I knew it would be an eye-opening experience. I have a background doing field work as a kind of as a sociologist. And so I knew going in, I thought, oh, this will be interesting. And it was. It was. To spend time, that much time, where I'm not like, I only got an hour to do this, but I mean, I got a whole week. And I'm sleeping on a mat, on a floor, in a homeless shelter. And something I had not thought about, but after a couple nights of that, you know, you're not sleeping real well. It's like having a newborn around, you know. And I thought, wow, for this to be your life would be a different matter. And I knew at the end of the week I was leaving. But with the homeless, you know, this is life for them. And one of the things that kind of opened my eyes to this, that I kind of knew but I hadn't really thought about, was they're not invisible to the public, especially on Broad Street. They're living and functioning amongst all this corporate America stuff that goes on. People busy with their days. And I know what this is like, where you don't pay that much attention to the homeless and what's going on. And I noticed with the homeless, I kind of studied the dynamic a little bit, where they don't bother making eye contact with other people. They just kind of shuffle along, you know, and do their thing. And I had time to visit with some. You know, you hear about a large segment of our population that are one paycheck away from homelessness. And there's a significant number there that I would visit with. And I find some of them had housing, had lives, but they stumbled upon hard times and didn't have anybody to help them out, lost their income, and they found themselves homeless. Anyway, in that, I got to thinking about it a lot as far as how we function in our society, and it's not just our society, I think it's kind of a global thing, that the message seems to be those who don't have enough material wealth to support themselves and become homeless are somehow lesser than people who have accumulated a great deal of wealth, or even middle class or whatever. And I don't think it's anything that's overtly spoken, anything that's overtly taught, but it's something that we just it's kind of an assumption there, and it is it's a false prophecy, because when you think about it, you don't have to think very much about it, but everybody's life counts equally. You know, we all are in this together. And our democracy is based on one person, one vote, so we're pretty good in compared to some of the other global societies. When you talk about situation in Turkey, trying to get the money to the right hands, that's a very real concern, because corruption can run so deep at times. But anyway, I do think we are left to find expressions of God in the everyday and amongst everyone. But something I would challenge you to consider is not just to look for the expressions of God, but there are times when you can be the expression of God. Not just look for the expression of God, but you can be the expression of God in the lives of others. And sometimes it can just be a simple gesture. Something to think about this week. Thank you.